Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Love and marriage, as the song says, go together like a horse and carriage, but much has changed since the horse and buggy days. Couples are marrying later. Fewer are divorcing. A new report from Bowling Green State University reveals that the rate of divorce among couples in the United States has dropped to a 35-year low. And this is good news for the health business. Joining us by phone is Ohio State University professor and vice chair of sociology and senior fellow at the Council on Contemporary Families, Christy Williams. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Anne. Happy to be here.
Studies have reported physical benefits from marriage. Like what?
That's right. There are a wide range of physical health benefits from marriage. We know that married people have lower rates of mortality, better overall self-rated health. They have fewer chronic conditions like cardiovascular disease. Later in life, they have lower rates of mobility limitations. They also have fewer depressive symptoms over their lifetime.
Is this a correlation or is there an actual causation here?
That is the question. Yeah. Obviously, the problem that we have in studying this is that we, you know, are not allowed as scientists to randomly assign some people to get married and some people to get divorced and then study what happens to their health, of course. So we're left with observational studies. We do have, you know, very high quality observational studies on representative samples of people that are followed over time. And so, you know, that research does show that, for example, individuals who move into marriage actually experience a, you know, at least a short-term improvement in health. And people who move out of marriage through divorce or widowhood experience declines in health, although there's some evidence that people generally tend to recover from those initial declines.
And I wonder if the declines aren't a function of the process of divorce.
That's exactly right.
Itself.
Right. Exactly. And so one of the ways of looking at this in the literature and in looking and trying to understand marital status differences in health is it that marriage provides resources that are health enhancing, or is it more that divorce and widowhood provides, you know, expose people to stressors that undermine health? And it looks like there's more support for the latter perspective.
Hmm.
Although certainly we do know that marriage on average, does provide a range of resources that are linked to better health.
And then how much does it throw a wrench into all the statistics and correlations and so forth now that same-sex marriage is legal?
Well, people are just really beginning to study how, you know, whether marriage provides the same benefits to couples in same-sex relationships as to opposite sex marriages. And so the research is very new and it's a hard population to study because it's relatively small. And so it's difficult in large nationally representative samples to get a big enough group of same-sex couples. But what we do know currently is that it does appear that whatever benefits of marriage accrue to the population in general does appear to apply to same-sex couples as well.
What about when you're not happy in a marriage?
Well, and that, I mean, that is the really important point. I mean, one big focus of my research really over the past 20 years has been in asking, sure, we know that marriage in general is associated with better health outcomes, but is that the same? Is that the same for everyone?
Mm-hmm.
And my conclusion is that there's so much heterogeneity, so much variability in marital statuses, differences in health, that those averages really don't tell us a lot. You really have to look at, again, who benefits and in some cases for whom marriage is costly. And really the big factor there, as you mentioned, is marital quality. And so we know from the research that, you know, being in a bad marriage is worse for both physical and mental health than being unmarried. So it's not just that any marriage is health enhancing. Marriage can actually be detrimental when it's linked to high conflict, as anybody in a high conflict marriage could probably tell you.
Right. How much marriage is one thing, feeling in love is another. How does that emotion factor into a person's health?
Well, when we try to understand what kind of resources marriage provides to people that may be health enhancing, there are really three factors. And one of the biggest ones is social support, right? And so social support, there are many different kinds of social support. Social support is just what we call instrumental, just sort of having someone there to help you, you know, manage the household and those kinds of things. But really, one of the most important forms of social support for health is emotional support, having a confidant, having someone who makes you feel loved and cared for. And, you know, marriage, on average, at least, makes that more available to people. And so we think that that's one of the primary mechanisms through which marriage confers health benefits. And one of the reasons that's so important is that it helps people cope with stress. So if you have an emotionally supportive relationship, you're much less vulnerable to the stressors that we all encounter. And we all know that stress takes a cumulative toll on health.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the physical benefits of being married. My guest is Christy Williams. She's a professor and vice chair of sociology at OSU and senior fellow at the Council on Contemporary Families. If you're listening right now, you have a story to tell about how marriage helped or maybe getting out of a marriage helped. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Do we know anything about, say, weight gain, other kinds of indicators of healthiness when it comes to marriage?
Yes, that's a very good question. I mentioned that there are sort of three big mechanisms through which marriage might confer health benefits. One is emotional support. The other is something that we call social control. And so one of the most interesting things about marriage is that it's often a very stabilizing force in people's life, and which we call social control. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot of fun, but social control, having someone around to kind of monitor your health, or what some people might say, nag you about your health, can have real benefits. And so we know, for example, that married people, with some exceptions, tend to engage in fewer risky health behaviors, like drinking excessively and smoking on average. You know, part of that probably comes from the commitment that comes with marriage, and people feel more responsible for taking care of their health and well-being. But the exception, when we think about marriage's influence on health behaviors, is weight gain. And so married people are more likely to be overweight than unmarried people.
Because
it may come partly also from that commitment aspect, from the kind of knowledge that you have a long-term partnership and you no longer have to attract a spouse with your fit and lean physique. So it kind of goes both ways.
What is the significance of physical touch, for instance, hugging, hand-holding, that kind of a thing?
That's a good question. That's a little bit outside of my area of expertise, but from what I do know, the literature there, I mean, there is some evidence that physical touch and hugging some benefits. It always makes me think of I have a 9-year-old son, and when he was smaller, he used to be fond of saying, "Hugs help." And he's right. I'm not going to question my son. Uh-huh. But I think that the research shows that hugging can help alleviate stress. And mainly, I think it's all a part of this emotional support aspect, which I talked about earlier, that it's a physical manifestation of the knowledge that one is loved and cared for. And again, we know that that helps people cope with stress.
You've studied the mental and physical health of single mothers and the benefit for marriage or cohabitation compared to childless women who marry. What did you find?
I found that this is another part of the point that I was making about how variable the effects of marriage on health are. And what we found was that for women who've had a non-marital birth, a birth without ever being married, later marriage does not seem to offer the health benefits that it does to the average population. In some cases, later marriage actually, but single mothers who later marry actually have worse health than those who don't marry. We're still kind of digging into that to see what the explanation is, but we think that it has to do with marriage just provides fewer economic benefits to single mothers who tend to have low levels of income and education themselves, and therefore the partners available to them do as well. And marriages of single mothers also tend to be characterized by more conflict. And so, again, getting back to that point that the benefits of marriage really depend on marital quality.
The Bowling Green news that I mentioned, 35-year low, is good news, but divorce still occurs. there are healthy divorces and there are very unhealthy divorces. What do you suggest for a healthy breakup? If you know somebody who's going through that, or if you are yourself out there, what do you want to tell our listeners?
Well, first, I want to say, you mentioned that this declining divorce rate is good news, and that certainly is the general consensus. But my colleague, Philip Cohen, another senior scholar at the Council on Contemporary Families, often says that we don't know what the optimal level of marriage in society is. In a similar vein, we also don't know what the optimal level of divorce is. And so, you know, we know that exiting a bad marriage can have some advantages. And so, you know, even though we tend to look at these declining divorce rate and say that's a good thing, and it probably is overall, it's not that divorce is always bad in every circumstance. It can lead to improvements for people. You know, in terms of dealing with divorce, that's a little bit sort of beyond my area of expertise, although I will say that we did do one study which found that the negative effects of divorce on psychological distress, a kind of an indicator of stress and mental health, were limited to people who had young children in the home at the time that they divorced. So for people who did not have young children, we really didn't see a big increase in depressive symptoms or psychological distress. And so that suggests that it's you know, having to continue to keep this relationship with a spouse while you're dealing with continuing to raise your young children together is a big source of stress for people. So, you know, thinking about ways to manage that if you're in that situation could probably be helpful.
Is there any evidence that you know of that says that a happy marriage isn't only about the adult couple but also about the children in terms of healthy, you know, in terms of physical health?
Well, I mean, certainly we know that we know that growing up in a two-parent home is associated on average with better outcomes for children than those who, you know, experience divorce. On the other hand, again, just like the research with adults, we also know that being in a household with high levels of marital conflict is also bad for children. So, I think we tend to look at these populations. We tend to look at effects for adults separately than effects for children. But certainly, I think it makes sense that how children cope with divorce probably has a big impact on its effect on parents as well.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Christy Williams, for joining us today. I appreciate it.
I enjoyed it. Thanks very much.
Talking about, you know, the physical impacts of a happy marriage, my guest, Christy Williams, professor and vice chair of sociology at Ohio State and senior fellow at the Council on Contemporary Families. More Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Ohio now leads the nation in opioid-related overdose deaths, according to state-by-state statistics compiled by the Henry J. Kaiser Family Foundation. For many, the addiction begins with legally prescribed painkillers, and physicians struggle to find the ethical balance between prescribing and overprescribing opioid pain medication. Dr. Ryan Nash is the director of the Ohio State University Center for Bioethics. His research explores the ethics and public policy of pain management and addiction. He joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
What do we know about why Ohio ranks so high in this category?
Well, I think there's much speculation, and the facts that we know are somewhat limited. We have to think about why people are abusing opioids. One, we know that many people that come to abuse opioids receive or start opioid use through legal means, that they receive opioids for pain or other symptoms from a physician, and they start using then. However, we have something else going on, which is a heroin epidemic that's somewhat different. Ohio was known for about decades, and I think your show's covered this, for some pill mills and other opioid abuse problems. And heroin traffickers have targeted Ohio as a market, if you will, ripe for the picking. So there's really two different things. One is the clear area that physicians are engaged in for opioid prescribing, which is the duty to treat patients versus the duty to protect patients or protect the society versus kind of the illegal drug epidemic that we're seeing that's related because that legally prescribed opioids in a way are kind of a gateway to the heroin epidemic. We're seeing, I think, all-cause death from opioid is still highest amongst prescribed opioids, with heroin quickly catching up. So both are a real problem.
And overdoses are often related to people who have been off the drug for a period of time and then fall back into it and overdose themselves.
There's a couple of there's many types of overdose. There's the unintentional overdose from legally prescribed and appropriately prescribed opioids, which I think is fairly low and fairly rare.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have the drug abuse overdose, where if you're taking an opioid in order to get a high, you're taking too much. You're going that euphoria is a toxicity. And so if you're taking so much that you're drug toxic, you're in danger. And then honestly, people that abuse opioids don't always know the pharmacy of the drugs and what mixes, and they mix drugs in such a way or use drugs inappropriately in such a way that the drug is really dangerous. For instance, methadone, we're seeing an increase of overdoses related to methadone. Well, methadone is a really stupid drug of abuse, to be frank. It's a large molecule that doesn't cross into the brain as readily and doesn't give that euphoria as easily as other drugs. So part of the reason we're seeing an increase in overdoses, abuse, some is legitimate. And then, all patients should that have been prescribed opioids, and when they're finished with that, should take their opioid to a drop box that the Attorney General has now made it easier for us to find those drop boxes. Mm-hmm. But if you've been on opioids in the past and you keep a stash at home and then you haven't had it for a while and then you go and you take a dose that, hey, a few years ago was what you needed, that's one of those accidental opioid overdose potential areas.
What role we've already talked about the pill mills a little bit, but we've also talked about on this show before how when opioids became a thing back in the 80s, doctors were told these are perfectly safe, they're completely non-addictive. I mean, it was just over and over and over again. It was amazing how that misinterpretation of one anecdote became sort of the industry standard for the safety of opioids. But some doctors still rely on them kind of, in a knee-jerk fashion.
Right. You're exactly right, Anne, on the timeline. I'm a hospice palliative care physician. I've cared for over 5,000 patients with terminal illness. I mean, so I know this struggle, not just from theory, but from having to make hard decisions with patients on a regular basis. The timeline really can go even further back. St. Basil the Great in the 4th century wrote about the use of opioids in people that were sick. That's 4th century. Sir William Osler, there were several comments along the way. Sir William Osler, one of the founders of American medicine, called it God's own medicine. He stole that term from someone else. But then there was this perceived era that opioids were not utilized, partly because we didn't have long-acting opioids, and there was this experience that people got on a roller coaster with opioids of pain being relieved, but then needing the drug, and it was really
more and more,
more and more, and higher doses. So that perception, which seemed to be accurate, that observation led to what was in the 80s and 90s perceived as kind of a neglect of patients with cancer and pain, and a few things happened around the 70s, 80s, and 90s that led to the rise of opioid prescribing. One is the realization of and the very visual realization of cancer patients still dying despite the war on cancer.
Mm-hmm.
So as people saw people suffering from cancer, there was a reaction, which is the modern hospice palliative medicine movement. Started in the UK, but then came to the US. So the home hospice and movement and then the palliative care movement really championed that we should have good symptom control for the dying. Another thing that brought it impact was the HIV epidemic and AIDS, seeing the very much in the forefront of people's minds. We saw pictures of tangible suffering before us, and there was a reaction to try to help that, to respond in compassion. I think all that is a good response. But then we thought, oh, well, if what we're experiencing is patients leave the hospital in utter distress and they go home to hospice, and all of a sudden with some opioids, they feel so much better, and they actually... they don't die any faster. Sometimes they actually live longer than we expect. How can we take that technique and technology and put it in the hospital and other sorts of care? A really good intention. Mm-hmm. But what came was pain becoming the fifth vital sign. Well, pain's subjective. It's not like the other vital signs. It's not like temperature or blood pressure. Pain is, on a scale of 1 to 10, how bad is your pain? Well, what score will an opioid addict give you, or a drug seeker? Or is pain really a good vital sign? But there was a whole movement to make pain the fifth vital sign. Also, all regulators began requiring pain responses from health systems and clinics. So if you have patients in pain, what are you going to do about it? Became a question for regulators.
Not just treat the illness, but treat
the symptoms. Right.
Yeah.
And then there were increasing quality metrics. So hospitals and health systems and clinics may voluntarily ask for these quality assurance programs. Now, that's voluntarily, but to be in the industry, you really have to do it. Mm-hmm. And those want the metrics on what are your average pain scores, and how a health system is ranked may be ranked in, like, U.S. News World Report, may be influenced by what are your pain scores for your postoperative patients or your cancer patients. So there's been a large drive to do something. And one of the hardest things for physicians is we already have a natural impulse to do something. It's hard for us to just listen and say, be empathetic, be present. We want to do something. And regulation and quality measures, we're tried to bring outcomes that would ensure that we do this. Another outcome that's really heavily involved is patient satisfaction. If you have a population, I don't want to guess on the population. I've seen differing numbers for Central Ohio. But if you have, let's just say, if you serve in a hospital that has 10% or 15% or 20% of the hospitalizations, they may have some sort of drug addiction issue, drug use disorder, whether it be nicotine, alcohol, or opioids. If you aren't prescribing what they want, their satisfaction score is not going to be that great. And when it comes to patient satisfaction, the difference between that 95th percentile and that 50th percentile is often only decimals of percentages. So health systems in the competition we have will pay a lot of attention to patient experience and patient satisfaction scores, but that may be to the detriment of physicians and health systems actually
at cross purposes.
Right. Out of wanting to do good for the patient, to actually not give them what they want.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the bioethics of prescribing opioids these days. We know that opioids are highly addictive, but doctors still want to treat their patients. They want their patients to feel better. My guest is Dr. Ryan Nash. He's director of the Ohio State University Center for Bioethics. If you have a question or comment, you can give him a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, there is some movement afoot to think about alternatives to medication. So I care about your pain. I want your pain to go away. But let's try something else first before we turn to this highly addictive drug.
Right.
But, you know, that's the medical community doesn't always buy into that kind of stuff, or there's not an availability of it, whether it's, biofeedback or whatever it might be. Can you talk about some of the alternatives?
Right. The challenge with all the alternatives is they don't give the immediate impact of an opioid.
Yeah.
Opioids are effective at immediately bringing some pain relief. Now, what we What we desperately need is more data on how to treat chronic pain. We know that acute pain or immediate pain after a surgery or when someone has a terminal illness or if someone has a fracture or something like this, opioids are still very safe and effective. But there was a dogma that developed in the hospice and palliative care movement that, one, there was no maximum dose of opioid, that it was the highest dose was the dose that's effective. And there was an experience that was fairly fairly safe, especially in the in patients that were terminally ill or had very advanced cancer. In chronic pain now, we're experiencing that's not the case at all, that long-term opioids, we see our goal in chronic pain is actually to decrease pain in order to increase activity and over time with hope to decrease the amount of opioid. But what we're seeing is the exact opposite. We're seeing in skyrocketing opioid doses, increasing pain, oddly enough, and decreasing activity. So opioids and chronic pain is a failure. And we have, they're a failure. They just don't work. And we know in specific diseases, such as osteoarthritis or low back pain, fibromyalgia, things like that, long-term opioid treatment is not effective and probably shouldn't be used. The alternatives, the biggest challenge we have is none of them are quite as effective at immediately giving relief. Now, using non-opioid pain medicines, whether they be the antidepressant types or the special kind of neurologic drugs like a few medications that like pregabalin or gabapentin, these nerve modulating drugs.
Lyrica or something like
Lyrica, Neurontin. That's pregabalin and gabapentin. Okay. And some antidepressants using acetaminophen works. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. non-steroidals, things like that. And then the other kind of alternative complementary therapies like acupuncture and massage and other things like that. Those types of approaches and cognitive behavioral therapy, which I think is actually quite effective with pain. Using alternative strategies, often patients are reluctant to move to those. Some insurers don't cover them. And a lot of their evidence base is mixed. Mm-hmm. So one of the greatest challenges we have is we need a better approach. We need medications that would may be effective other than opioids.
Other than being addictive. Right. I mean, I'll tell you that. Tom, in Columbus, you're on the air with Dr. Ryan Nash of Ohio State University Center for Bioethics. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Greetings, Ann Fisher, Dr. Nash. I'm going to state the question, and then you may need some clarification. I think part of the problem of the opioid problem, prescription drugs, is really a doctor problem. And how are we going to begin to deal with this doctor problem?
Like, what do you mean by doctor problem?
Indiscriminately prescribing narcotics.
Okay. So.
Okay, and for social economic reasons.
All right, what do you mean by that?
Okay.
And try to be brief.
I
know.
If a doctor has, I'm throwing out a number. If a doctor has 100 patients and 75 of the patients on narcotics,
okay.
If he does what's right, he's going to lose 75 patients and stuck with 25. How is it going to pay?
Yeah, I get you.
And
Ryan Nash is nodding his head right now. He knows exactly what you're talking about. So, Tom, hang on a second.
Tom, you're right. The current system has an economic inducement some systems even encourage rapid evaluations. The easiest thing for a physician to do is I have patient with pain, will prescribe opioid, and the pain is dealt with. The pain score decreases. Patient satisfaction numbers are fine. Everything that our system and healthcare reform is looking at in kind of outcomes-based medicine is satisfied. And, hey, you're able to bill for multiple patients an hour instead of taking a lot of time to go through many things with just a couple of patients an hour. So I do think the system has kind of perverse incentives to further this. There are some things. So you ask, what are we going to do? One, we should know that the many things are happening. Right at now, it's at the level of education. So the Ohio State Medical Association has launched a couple of programs, one targeting physicians and health professionals. It's called the Smart RX program, and it was co-sponsored, I think, by the governor's office. But it is tailored for health professionals to try to educate them on some best practices in opioid prescribing. It's not mandatory at this point, but it is trying to further that education. There's also, I think one of the important things is to educate the public on the appropriate use of opioids. Many patients have unrealistic expectations of what opioids can do, especially over a long period of time. And so the Ohio State Medical Association, again, has what we call the Be Smart program.
Is there any protocol for when a physician prescribes an opioid to sit down for 2 minutes and say, this is a highly addictive drug? It's really important that you understand. I mean, a lot of pharmacists say, do you have any questions for the pharmacist? How many times do people say, yeah, I actually do? Most times they say no. But what about that when a doctor prescribes something that's so addictive?
Well, they're clearly, that's in the best practices. So any publication that comes out from a medical board or from various organizations,
they should be doing that. And a patient should expect that.
The patient should expect that. Doctors' offices aren't going to be bugged with regulators saying, did you do it?
Right.
But there are some safety mechanisms. You know, an opioid prescription is only valid for a month. Best practices are that patients are being seen monthly or every 90 days at least. So there is at least the awareness that there needs to be regular attention to that.
Okay, Tom, thanks a lot for that question. It was a good one. And Greg in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Greg.
How you doing? My question is about medical marijuana and the fact that anecdotally they've shown that in areas where medical marijuana is introduced or just even recreational marijuana, the use of opioids has gone down. And I heard of a study a long time ago where they was trying to prove the addictive qualities of marijuana, and the two main things that didn't happen was usually an animal will refuse food or sex for their drug, but when marijuana was introduced, even if they were addicted to the other drugs, caffeine included, that introduced the marijuana made the subjects and the animals increase eating and engage in intercourse.
All right. Well, just as far as treating pain and that kind of a thing, there hasn't been a lot of studies because it's illegal.
Right. So, I mean, I've signed off on medical marijuana only in that it should be studied and should be allowed to be studied. I think there are some studies now that especially men that previously smoked marijuana and liked it respond well for that medical marijuana has good pain outcomes and their overall need for opioids decreases. So there's some promise there. However, right now, I think with marijuana, we have a lot of kind of euphoria, if you will, where you have people that think it's all bad or people that think it should, frankly, be completely legal. I think Ohio's has fairly a moderate position on this. The type of medical marijuana that Ohio's looking at is not smoked marijuana. It's vaped or oral oil, things like this, edibles. And if that's done with the proper research and evidence base, I think it may have a place. However, I think we're going to learn a lot of negatives about marijuana from the states that have legalized it outright. I mean, it has a stigma for a reason.
Are we studying them? Do you know?
There are a lot of marijuana researchers. There's a whole new journal on marijuana medicine that is coming out. So I think we will learn quite a bit over the next 5 to 10 years. I think Ohio is taking a cautious approach. I'm reluctant. I know I have patients that use it illegally. I don't encourage it. I tell them it's illegal and I give them alternatives. But I'm not on the marijuana bandwagon yet. But I'm for researching it as like other drugs that we would pass through the FDA. And if it's safe and effective, it may be something we can use in the armamentarium. But I'm a bit cautious.
Dr. Ryan Nash, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Yeah,
We've been talking about the issue of opioids, opioid addiction, opioid overdoses, and the role of doctors, physicians, hospitals, and the patient in avoiding addiction and overdose. We'll continue Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. When someone says she has cancer, it's natural to respond with, "How are you?" But that might not help, and in fact, it might hurt. Stan Goldberg is a communications specialist and retired professor of communicative disorders at San Francisco State University. He's written about his own experience with cancer and what helps when it comes to talking with someone who has cancer. His new book is entitled Loving, Supporting, and Caring for the Cancer Patient, A Guide to Caring, Compassion, and Courage. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show, Professor Goldberg.
Oh, thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
Why did you write this book? What spurred you to deal with this part of cancer?
Well, about 20 years ago, a good friend of mine called me and out of the blue said, "Stan, I just want you to know I have end-stage breast cancer." And I didn't know how to respond, so I think what most people say when they hear that kind of news, which is, "I'm so sorry to hear that." And I thought about it afterwards, and I thought, you know, it did express the compassion I had towards her, but how helpful really was that statement? And I forgot about it for many years until I was diagnosed with cancer. And when I inform friends and acquaintances of the diagnosis, I found they said the exact same thing to me that I said 20 years prior to that to my friend, "We're so sorry to hear that." And following that, I became a hospice bedside volunteer. And what I found was the experience that I had was very similar to the experience of many of the patients I cared for. And I realized that it was important not only to express compassion, but to take that compassion and put it in a form that was going to be useful and practical. And so I gathered up all of the stories that my patients had given me for 8 years, my experiences, the experiences of people that I counseled, and that became the basis for this book, which contains over 260 practical ways of helping someone cope with cancer.
So is the idea that when you say, "I'm sorry," or when you say, "Well, gosh, how are you?" That's how can that be harmful? Or is it put your money where your mouth is or put your actions where your mouth is?
Well, it's not harmful. I don't think it's ever harmful expressing compassion. But someone who has just had a cancer diagnosis, whether it is something that has a very negative prognosis or is indeterminate or even a positive prognosis, you know, that person is really in the process of changing their whole life. And in that process, they need to have actions taken by people that will help them on that journey. So no, it is, you know, I mean, always express your compassion, express your caring, but couple it with something that's going to be helpful.
And then also be aware that you're not the first person and won't be the last to say, "I'm sorry." I mean, after a while, when it comes to the patient themselves, they're hearing this in a different way than you're saying it.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, what I found is the people that I've counseled, after having a cancer diagnosis, there are so many things in their lives that are now seen through the cancer. And even though you might express a very common feeling or something that is supportive, they are hearing it, "Yes, this is the 80th time I've heard this in the past month." So, yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, the words after a while are not going to be as meaningful as actions.
So What, all right, there's different levels of relationships too. Sometimes I hear from people who say, I was so surprised, I was sick, and somebody I barely know found out and they brought a casserole over. Some people who are really close to me quit calling me. People respond differently, right? You know, does it matter?
Let me address the first part. Yes, you know, people do respond differently. People tend to think that those who are diagnosed with cancer all react the same way. We don't. We bring our history and our values into our diagnosis, and that's how we look at people's responses, both words and actions. And yes, you know, some people, you know, hear someone has cancer and their first reaction is to go mute, not to offer anything because they're afraid of saying something that's offensive. Other people want to do whatever they can. So there is a wide variety. And I think those of us who are living with cancer understand that. And our expectations shouldn't be that everyone is going to react in the best way that we identify what makes sense.
How much are people, or how often, or what do we know about how people who are diagnosed with something like cancer or some serious life-threatening illness, how much they're counseled to understand and to communicate themselves with other people?
Well, I think the area of counseling for people with cancer is underutilized. And I'm not sure why. My guess is that just as those of us who are diagnosed with cancer have a fear about dealing with the end of our lives, possible end of our lives, I think so do some professional counselors. So there's this feeling that if we don't talk about it, we can deal with it better. And I found the exact opposite to take place. People who are on a cancer journey need to feel comfortable talking about what they're experiencing and the possibility that they may die with someone who can not only be compassionate but also objective.
A cancer diagnosis, particularly a serious one, end stage, is kind of a form of chaos, right, in somebody's life?
It is tremendous chaos. And you know, the chaos occurs not only with a terminal prognosis, but it occurs from the mere mention of the words cancer. You know, I think a lot of people want to sort of lump cancer in with other disorders and saying, well, what, you know, how is that different than, let's say, heart failure or something else? The problem, I think, a lot is associated with how we view the word cancer and its course. I've had people who've had the last cancer treatment was 20 years ago. Other people, and there's been no recurrence. Other people just finished chemotherapy, and some folks are actively undergoing treatment. It doesn't seem to make a difference where someone is in that process. The uncertainty by having a cancer diagnosis pervades everything in their lives. And I think that quite, you know, often isn't understood. You know, I view, you know, my actions currently, even though I've been able to cope with the cancer for 13 years, I view everything through that label, and so do most people living with cancer.
In your book, you remind supporters that they should expect a feeling of helplessness.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the most difficult things for caregivers and loved ones to have. And that is, as much as they want to help, sometimes there's nothing they can do other than to literally and figuratively hold their loved one's hand as they're on this journey. You know, and it becomes even more difficult when we know that the treatment is either no longer working or the person has decided that they really don't want any more treatments. And to, you know, to just be next to a person who knows they're going to die or they're going to be experiencing tremendous pain is difficult for caregivers. And I think that's probably one of the hardest things that they're going to have to deal with, is that feeling of helplessness, of seeing someone you love in pain or facing death and knowing the only thing you can do is be there for support.
What about as a friend of somebody, can you just ask somebody who has cancer, what can I do for you? Or can you ask them, how much do you want to talk about this? Do you want me to get on the internet and start Googling the world for a cure? Or what do you offer?
Well, I think that that's a very important question. Most people are under the assumption that if someone tells them that they have cancer, the best thing to do is to say, well, call me if you need anything. And actually, what I've found from the people that I've counseled is that's not the best thing to do. And quite often, when someone is very general about their offer to help, the person who is in the position of accepting that help does not view it as necessarily meaningful. I'll give you a very good example. I had a friend of mine who was just undergoing chemotherapy, and I knew that after the chemotherapy, she was going to be exhausted. So instead of saying to her, tell me what I can do after you've had the first infusion, what I said to her was, I know Thursdays are the day you do your grocery shopping. Why don't I come over and we can shop together? I can load the things into the car. I can put them in the cabinets, and you know, then you could rest for the rest of the day. Now, for her, there was nothing I could have said that would have been more helpful than that. So my advice to people is don't be general. Be very specific. And I think you'll find that the person who you're making the offer to will appreciate that more than anything that's more general.
So you could say, like, I go get my massage therapy on Tuesdays. What if I book an appointment for you the same time and we can go together?
Perfect.
Okay.
Absolutely perfect.
You describe loved ones often taking the role as a cheerleader, and what's the issue with that?
You know, it's something that I've wrestled with for a long time, especially with my own family. When I told them my diagnosis and the fact that the prognosis at that time was very indefinite, what they kept saying was, well, don't worry, you'll get over this, it's not that bad. And they were doing that in order to buoy up my spirits. What I had to explain to them was, as much as I appreciated what they were trying to do, there's sometimes that reality trumps the best of intentions. So it's you know, caregivers and loved ones walk this fine line. If they, on one side is being a cheerleader, being unrealistic, on the other side, it's being too depressive about what's happening. And they need to walk that ridge where, yes, you know, I really hope things get better. But if they don't, let's talk about what we can do to make, you know, whatever you're going through as less distressful as possible. So, yeah, it's, you know, and it's, there's another problem with cheerleading, and that's if someone is offering that kind of support, the understanding is we're all in this together. We all can struggle hard. We'll do the right things, and we'll overcome it. Well, what happens when you don't? Mm-hmm. What happens when, despite your best efforts, both physically and spiritually, the person is going farther down that cancer road? Well, I've had people say to me, I've had all this great support, but the problem is it didn't help, and I started feeling guilty that I wasn't doing what I should have. So, yes, be positive, but don't be a cheerleader.
We're just about out of time, but I wanted to ask you, I talked to somebody once who said how frustrated they were. Frustrated is not the right word, but uncomfortable they were when people constantly said, we're praying for you, we're, you know, sending prayers. They were an atheist, and it bothered them. What about that whole thing?
I think you have to know the person that you're saying it to. If someone is atheistic or agnostic, you know, you don't necessarily want to say, I'm praying for you, because it may not mean that much. But if you say to them, I know that you're not religious, but the way that I'm going to try to help is I will pray for you, that's fine.
Okay. Dr. Stan Goldberg, thanks so much for your time.
You're very welcome.
It's Dr. Stan Goldberg. His new book is entitled Loving, Supporting, and Caring for the Cancer Patient, A Guide to Caring, Compassion, and Courage. Thanks for listening today. This is Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.